Tel Aviv stepping up crackdown on Palestinians following the Friday retaliatory attack in the occupied Al-Quds that has claimed the lives of 7 Israelis. The Qatari foreign minister is in Tehran. He's discussed regional and global issues with his Iranian counterpart and conveyed messages from JCPOA signatories. And Tehran says the unsuccessful drone attack in Isfahan has nothing to do with other incidents in Iran. It blames Western media for spreading false propaganda. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israel is taking drastic measures in response to the recent shooting attacks in occupied Al-Quds. Tel Aviv is making it easier for Israelis to obtain gun permits and encouraging those with licenses to carry their weapons. The regime also says that it will demolish the homes of suspected Palestinian attackers and revoke certain rights of their families, including their social security benefits. Israel has also promised new steps to expand illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military is sending more troops into occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian man near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus earlier in the day. Israeli media claims the Palestinian was in possession of a gun and suspected of carrying out a shooting operation. On Friday, a Palestinian man killed 7 Israelis near a synagogue in Al-Quds. One day later, a 13-year-old Palestinian boy injured 2 Israelis. The incidents followed an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp, which claimed the lives of 9 Palestinians. Our correspondent Ramallah, Mona Kandil, has provided us with more details on the recent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank.
When Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decided, following the meeting of the cabinet, that settlements would be expanded, that there would be a new plans for the settlements in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds, this is definitely would be encouraging the settlers to continue their aggression and violence against Palestinians. 150 settler attacks had been carried out, including 144 attacks by the settlers only last night and early on Sunday in the Nablus province, Nablus area. Early on Sunday, Israeli settlers set a house and a parked car ablaze in the area of Tur Musaiya. It's near Ramallah and northeast Ramallah, of course. And in Douma, this village near Nablus, a number of Palestinian vehicles had been shattered, and the windows of a number of Palestinian homes had been also smashed by Israeli settlers. In total, 144 attacks had been carried out by the Israeli settlers only yesterday and early on Sunday.
Tensions are running high in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. Shooting operations have now become regular occurrences, leading to high casualties among Israelis. Palestinians carry out the attacks in retaliation for deadly Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli crimes have been met with the silence of the international community.
The situation in Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds remains volatile after a number of shooting operations there took the lives of at least 9 people and wounded several others. In the latest incident, 2 Israelis were wounded in an operation in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds on Saturday morning. The Israeli Emergency Medical Services said one of those injured was in critical condition. The shooter, identified as a 13-year-old Palestinian, was wounded. The incident was the second Palestinian operation in Al-Quds in less than a day. On Friday, at least 7 people were killed and several others wounded in a shooting operation outside a synagogue in the Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds. Resistance movements held the operation. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, praised the attack as a courageous operation. It said the attack was a natural response to the Israeli occupation and the regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Al-Quds Brigades said the operation is a testament to unity among resistance groups. Hamas also lauded the operation. The movement said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will pay the price for any new mistake that Tel Aviv could make. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement also separately praised the action. The Friday incident followed a Thursday Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed in cold blood by Israeli troops. Thursday marked the deadliest day for the Palestinians since the start of the new year. Israeli troops barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed a hospital in Jenin and intentionally fired tear gas towards its pediatrics department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. All what is going on in the occupied territories is happening in the silence of the international community. The mainstream media closed its eyes to the deadliest Israeli raid on the Palestinian community in the occupied land this year, and instead, they took the side of the Israelis in the recent tensions. From the United States to Germany, to France and Ukraine, almost everyone expressed concern about the lives of Israelis during the recent violence.
Israel continues to escalate its violence against Palestinians with no end in sight. But what is the regime ultimately trying to achieve? Does it hope to put an end to the Palestinian operations, or is it effectively committing ethnic cleansing by stripping Palestinians of their identity and removing them from their ancestral land?
The storming of the Jenin refugee camp is indicative of the regime's aggressive nature in dealing with Palestinians, especially since the emergence of extremist ideologies in the Israeli cabinet. Many argue that the current Israeli cabinet is the most extremist ever since its installation in the occupied land. What highlights this extremism is the recent storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Many brand the minister's move as the root cause of all the recent tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The latest flare-up of Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank brings to the question the regime's motive behind such escalations. One presumption is that the regime is only after taking out the total Palestinian identity from their land. In order to do that, what could be better than suppressing them by imposing an all-out blockade on millions of Palestinians and blocking their access to the outer world? To support that presumption, it is enough to say that the Israeli cabinet is planning to deport Palestinian families, at least those who the regime deems as terrorists, from their own land. That's why it pushes ahead with its policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Many are convinced that this amounts to utter collective punishment and ethnic cleansing. There is no doubt that what the Israeli regime is doing now in the occupied land, in terms of demolition and other practices, will definitely backfire. What could be around the corner for the Israeli occupying regime is yet another intifada waiting to happen. After all, Palestinian resistance has entered a new phase, and so many young people are taking part in the operations against the Israeli regime. Grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime, like the Den of Lions. The Den of Lions is an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The group emerged in August 22 following the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces. Anti-Netanyahu rallies are being held on a weekly basis, with protesters not caring about what is happening to the Israelis in the occupied land, but rather taking aim at a prime minister who is indicted on grave charges and is willing to evade laws to do whatever he can. All in all, point to a situation where things are pulling the Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
The Iranian parliament speaker urges Islamic countries to cooperate to thwart Zionist plots. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf is in Algeria participating in an OIC parliamentary union conference. He's met with his Algerian counterpart Ibrahim Bougali on the sidelines of the conference in the capital, Algiers. In this meeting, Ghalibaf called for further bilateral ties between Iran and Algeria. The speaker also expressed hope that the summit would be effective in subverting plots aimed at shattering unity among Islamic countries. The Algerian official, for his part, described the Palestinian cause as the main issue of today's world. Some 40 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation are attending the event, along with 20 parliament speakers. Iran says it's ready to offer any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to reestablish education for women in that country.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan, in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Hussein Ahmed Abdullahian made the remarks during a press conference with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He stressed that Iran seeks to promote dialogue with its neighbors and Persian Gulf countries to establish lasting security in the region. Amir Abdullahian also addressed the recent Israeli crimes in Al-Quds, Jenin, and the West Bank, which have led to the death of over 30 Palestinians. He stressed that the issue of Palestine is the first priority in the Islamic world. Meanwhile, the Qatari foreign minister said that he is carrying messages from parties to the nuclear deal between Iran and the five world powers known as the JCPOA.
The U.S. has given us messages to relay to Iran. Qatar thinks it's the best time to resolve the issues blocking the 2015 nuclear accord and come to an agreement to revive it and finalize a deal.
The Iranian foreign minister expressed the Islamic Republic's gratitude for Qatar's efforts in reviving the nuclear deal. He added that Tehran welcomes any initiative from Qatar aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. Amir Abdullahian also hinted at the U.S. and the European trio's unproductive role and intervention in the recent riots in Iran. Two foreign ministers also discussed enhancing bilateral and economic relations in both governments and private sectors. Tehran has rejected corporate media's hypes relating a thwarted drone attack on a defense ministry workshop in Isfahan to other incidents as exaggerated and wrong. Iran's defense ministry has waved off any relation between the drone attack on the Isfahan workshop and a fire accident in Azarshahr. Officials say the blaze in Azarshahr was due to a leak from worn-out pipes in an engine oil manufacturing plant. It added that no explosion has occurred in Hamadan either, despite media reports. The defense ministry says that Zionist-led corporate media tend to use the unsuccessful drone attack to launch a widespread psychological war against Tehran. Iran's air defense batteries shot down a micro-drone over a defense ministry workshop earlier in the day in what the ministry has called a much-anticipated attack by the enemy. Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the second exhibition of geomatics and its related technologies. The annual event aims to unveil the country's latest advances in the strategic sector. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Geomatics is not a well-known term amongst the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in man's modern life. The second Iran Geo Exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in the field.
Geo means earth, and geomatics is a science and technology that deal with the collection, distribution, and analysis of geographic data using aerial and satellite imaging. To put it simply, when you take an online cab, you're using a geomatic technology known as GPS, which is short for Global Positioning System.
Geomatics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in geomatics.
We develop aerial imaging and surveying technologies. We also offer geophysical services. Here in this expo, we're showcasing our imaging and surveying drones, which can draw maps and collect topographical data to facilitate mining operations.
As the organizer of the tech event, the Iranian Defense Ministry says it is planning to encourage more companies to operate in geomatics to turn the strategic field into a viable source of income for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Geomatics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing geomatics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without geomatics, many businesses such as online ride-sharing services would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has fired Conservative Party Chairman Nadeem Zahawi over tax affairs. Sunak says that Zahawi's removal is due to a serious breach of the ministerial code. The Prime Minister had initially stood by the Tory chairman before ordering an independent advisor to investigate his tax affairs. It emerged that Zahawi did not declare that he was being probed over tax issues when he briefly took charge as finance minister last year and failed to disclose details when Sunak appointed him to his current role. The opposition Labour Party has slammed Sunak for showing weakness in handling the Zahawi case. The sacking comes as Sunak's government is facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strikes. In a tragic day for Pakistan, at least 50 people have died in two separate incidents in the country. 41 bodies were retrieved after a bus plunged off a bridge and burst into flames in Balochistan province in southwestern Pakistan. Local authorities said three survivors had been rescued, while four others remain missing. Local officials say an investigation has been launched. Separately, 10 children were killed when a boat capsized in the northwest of the country. All of those killed were between the ages of 7 and 14. Police say that efforts are underway to rescue others on the boat. The U.S. city of Memphis has disbanded the special police unit whose officers fatally beat a young black man. The Memphis Police Department said it was in the best interest of all to permanently deactivate the unit. That came after protesters took to the streets in Memphis and other U.S. cities. They demanded justice for the death of Tyre Nichols after a video was released showing police violently arresting the young black man. He died a few days later after the incident. The five officers involved in the incident have been charged with murder, assault, and kidnapping, amongst other charges. Murder has been a major source of public outcry in the U.S., recently thrown into the spotlight of George Floyd in 2020. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The discovery of classified documents from one of U.S. President Joe Biden's offices and also his home, as well as former Vice President Mike Pence's house, has attracted media attention. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Officials confirmed on Tuesday, 24th of January, documents with classified markings were found recently at former Vice President Mike Pence's Indiana home. Mike Pence's team notified the National Archives recently that a small number of documents were inadvertently boxed and transported to the former vice president's home at the end of the last administration. Mike Pence's lawyer wrote to the archives, "The vice president was unaware of the existence of sensitive or classified documents at his personal residence." The findings at Mike Pence's residence come as President Joe Biden faces mounting criticism, which had also come from Mike Pence, over the discovery of classified materials at Biden's old office at a Washington, D.C. think tank and at his Delaware home. Greg Jacob, the attorney representing Mike Pence, wrote to the National Archives that Pence used outside counsel with experience handling classified documents to review records stored at his personal home after several classified documents were found at Joe Biden's home recently. Lawyers conducting the search found a small number of documents that could potentially contain sensitive or classified information interspersed throughout the records. Mike Pence's team was unable to provide an exact number of documents recovered or additional descriptions of the materials because they were locked away until they could be turned over to the National Archives. In a Sunday, 22nd of January letter to the National Archives, Greg Jacobs explained that FBI agents came to Mike Pence's home on Thursday night, 19th of January, to collect the documents that had been stored away. He indicated that Mike Pence agreed to turn over the two boxes with materials containing classified markings, as well as two other boxes with copies of administration records. Greg Jacobs expressed confidence that a thorough review would find the majority of documents in all four boxes were copies of records that had already been sent to the National Archives. The findings at Mike Pence's home make him the third former or current top U.S. official to have stored classified materials from his time in office at his home, following Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. The Presidential Records Act requires presidents and vice presidents to turn documents over to the National Archives for proper preservation after their elected terms end. While Joe Biden and Mike Pence notified the National Archives and turned over the materials, Donald Trump was uncooperative with federal officials after they requested he return documents stored at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. The fight culminated in an FBI search at Mar-a-Lago last August, and the Justice Department has appointed a special counsel to investigate Donald Trump's handling of classified materials, as well as his actions surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. FBI Director Christopher Wray on Thursday, 26th of January, lamented the frequent mishandling of classified documents following the recent discovery of classified materials at former Vice President Mike Pence's Indiana home. Christopher Wray said at a press conference on Thursday, "We have had for quite a number of years any number of mishandling investigations. That is unfortunately a regular part of our counterintelligence division's counterintelligence programs work. The small number of documents found at Mike Pence's home follow a series of classified documents being discovered that have plagued President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump." Christopher Wray said, "People need to be conscious of the rules regarding classified information and appropriate handling of classified materials. Those rules are there for a reason." According to CNN, in the wake of the slew of discoveries, the National Archives have reportedly asked former presidents and vice presidents to search their personal records to ensure they do not inadvertently contain any presidential records, including classified materials. Mike Pence was asked in Iowa last summer in the wake of the FBI search whether he had retained classified information upon leaving office. He said at the time, "No, not to my knowledge." Pence has been among the Republicans criticizing Joe Biden in recent weeks over the discovery of classified documents at his old office and at his Wilmington, Delaware home. From Biden's time as vice president and as a Delaware senator, Mike Pence praised the decision to appoint a special counsel to investigate Joe Biden's handling of these documents, arguing it would have been a double standard to name one of Donald Trump's case, but not the current president's. The former vice president was also critical of the Biden White House for waiting roughly 2 months to disclose that it found classified materials at the president's old office from the time they were first discovered on 2nd of November 2022. Mike Pence is weighing whether to run for president in 2024, having visited early voting states including Iowa, South Carolina, and New Hampshire frequently over the past year. It's unclear whether recent disclosures will affect his standing with voters, but some were quick to highlight how his handling of the documents compared to Donald Trump. The website Axios has also covered this story and tells us more. A new ABC News Ipsos opinion poll finds strong majorities of Americans believe that both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump acted inappropriately when it came to their handling of classified documents. But in weighing their severity, a plurality of the public believes Donald Trump's actions were more serious. Over three-quarters of the public, or 77%, feel that Donald Trump acted inappropriately in the way he handled classified files, while 64% say the same for Joe Biden. Condemnation expectedly aligns along party lines, with 96% of Democrats saying that Donald Trump's handling of classified documents was not appropriate, compared to 47% of Republicans. Per the ABC News Ipsos opinion poll conducted using Ipsos's Knowledge Panel, more than 8 in 10 independents, or 83%, believe that Donald Trump's behavior was inappropriate. Reaction to Joe Biden's actions on this matter similarly varies by party, with 89% of Republicans saying that Joe Biden's handling of classified documents was not appropriate, compared to 38% of Democrats and two-thirds of independents. Both Biden and Trump are under heavy scrutiny due to the discovery of classified files located amid personal items or in unsecured facilities, instead of housed at the National Archives where they belong, though there are key differences in each case. This opinion poll finds that more than twice as many Americans think that Donald Trump's actions were more severe than Joe Biden's, with 43% saying Trump's behavior was a more serious concern, and 20% saying Joe Biden's behavior was more serious. Still, nearly a third of the public, or 30%, finds the actions of both to be equally serious. Partisan breakdowns once again show a stark contrast, with the overwhelming majority of Democrats, 84%, saying Donald Trump's behavior was more serious, compared to a thin 7% of Republicans who say the same. Although they are likely to give more leeway to the former president, Republicans seem less bullish here, with only a bare majority, or 53% of those identifying with the GOP, saying Biden's handling of classified documents was more serious. Independent voters are much more likely to say Donald Trump's behavior was more serious than Joe Biden's, with 43% to 14%.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the movement of the late Imam Khomeini as a preparation for the reappearance of Imam As. Of course, there is a lot to say, if we can't say, about Imam As. As you said, his reappearance, the quality of his reappearance. But all in all, Sheikh Rouhani, there are some goals for, we can say, when Imam As is in occultation, and there are some responsibilities upon the shoulders of the Muslims and the Muslim leaders. Do you believe that in today's world, the Muslims are really acting upon the guidelines of Imam As?
You know, obviously, if you are a true Muslim, an active and, let's say, practical kind of Muslim,
yes.
If you practice the Islamic rulings, the true Islamic rulings, then, of course, you are fulfilling your responsibilities, I mean, religious responsibilities. If you do not do that, of course, it's clear that you are not a true Muslim and you're not fulfilling or, let's say, performing your responsibility. It depends on what way you live, what is your lifestyle, yeah?
Yes.
So this is the first point. The second point is that if you know the Islamic rulings, you have to perform it, and you will perform it if you know.
Yes.
But the problem is that sometimes the people do not know what is the real and the true rulings of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they cannot perform it.
Yes.
Because of this, we believe that the jurists or the fuqaha who are who will know the really know or perfectly know actually the Islamic rulings, they must be the leaders.
Yes.
And they should train the people, and yes, they should lead the people, and they should be even the political leaders.
And what are the characteristics of this awaiting for the Imam As? Because we know nowadays so many people await the reappearance of Imam As. The case is that, what are the main characteristics of this waiting system?
Well, first of all, we need to make our concepts right.
Mm-hmm.
When we say this is a political movement,
yes,
we are talking secularly,
okay,
about the religion and the politics and other fields of life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Islam says that politics is within religion, economics is within religion, social justice or everything is within the religion. There is no difference between the, you know, the systems that we have in the world.
That's right.
Secularly, the way they say.
Okay.
When we say a political movement, that is at the same time it's a religious movement.
Uh-huh. A religio-political movement.
Now you want to say religio-political, you want to add this.
Yes.
But it is purely religion.
Okay.
It's a pure religion that says that Islam purely talks about justice. You know, the main difference between the Islamic system and other systems in the world, for example, capitalism or we can say like socialism and other thing, is that Islam talks about justice.
Yes.
In all the fields. Now, if it is the justice for the people, that we'll call the political movement, something
okay
like that. But Islam is about justice, and that's it. So basically, when we say that this is a different movement from the religion, this is wrong. We should not say this, because this is a pure religious movement which has politics in it, which
yes
has education in it, which has social justice in it, which has all the aspects of life in it.
Yes.
That's why when you think about this movement as an Islamic perspective or religious perspective, there's no difference in it.
That's right.
And this difference will be will be raised
yes
from the minds.
Mm-hmm.
The main point, the main problem is because we think secularly, we've been taught from the schools in the
yes
college or university,
okay,
we've been injected this secular thought. That's why we think that how can this political movement, because we are looking at a revolution or a country, when we're talking about the country or the political movements, as politics different from something else.
Yes.
That's why we take it different. Otherwise, it's the same thing. And when it is same, then obviously it is according to the Islam. Right. There's no difference in it.
Okay. And is Imam As Sheikh Rouhani the last hope in order to revive the original concepts of Islam? Because the Shiite believes in the Isna Shari, to 12 Shia Imams, believe that the presence of this holy Imam would be the last hope in order to revive the original Islam and Islamic teachings and guidelines, especially in today's world, because day by day that we are passing in modern world, the religion is losing its color, isn't it?
Yes, of course. You know, because we believe that all the Imams, including the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they are nurun wahid.
Okay.
They are like one single light.
Yes.
To the people, for the people. So, of course, when there is darkness, this light will shed light on those, let's say, darkness of our life or dark sides of our life. So, of course, Imam al-Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif will be, of course, the real, we can say, reviver of the true Islam. Because even nowadays, when we see the fuqaha of Islam, if you look at their risala or tawdih al-masail, they say that, of course, we tried our best to get the true, for example, ruling of Islam.
Yes.
But sometimes we believe that it might happen to even the fuqaha. They could not understand the most true and the authentic real hukm of Islam.
Yes.
But yeah, our responsibility is nowadays is this, to follow this maraj. Yeah?
Yes.
And inshallah, we will be forgiven by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if there were some mistakes.
Okay.
But when it comes to the Imam al-Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu, there will never be any kind of mistakes in his rulings and his ahkam in his time. And of course, he will bring back the true Islam and let's say the most authentic teachings and doctrines of Islam. Yes,
that's right. So in order to, we can say, find the pure Islam, because nowadays there are so many, we can say, the disagreements on a special ruling. For example, this faqih's viewpoints might be very much different from the other ones, okay? And on a specific issue. Or it's better to say in ruling the country, in ruling the countries, okay? For example, a political or a social viewpoint might be very much different from the other one. But the case is that Imam As's idea, and there is no link, as they say, direct link between the leaders of a Muslim land with Imam As. So it makes it very much harder in order to have the clear picture of what Imam As exactly thinking.
Well, obviously, when we talk about Imam al-Asr, alayhi salam, what he thinks is everything which is in the Quran.
Okay.
What he will apply is whatever the Prophet has done.
Yes.
The waliyya faqih, wilayat al-faqih, the concept of the wilayat al-faqih is the same concept, that whatever is in the Quran, whatever has been said by the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam and the Aima alayhim salatu wasalam, that should be applied in a country. And that's why it is much closer to what Imam al-Asr will do when he will do the reappearance. Okay. And that's why when we look at
Still, you believe that this will not be the most comprehensive.
This is not the perfect, we can say. It is not perfect
model.
Why? Because the wali al-faqih or the jurist himself is a fallible person, right? And whatever is he, you know, applying or doing, it's according to his research.
Yes.
And the answer to the question where you said like the jurists have difference in their rulings, the difference is in the methodology.
Mm-hmm.
For example, how to see the moon, the first moon, like
the first month
for the Ramadan or the Eid when we see. So basically, the rule is the same. The rule is you need to see the moon.
Yes.
Now, the methods are different.
Mm-hmm.
One says you can use the telescope. The other says you cannot use the telescope, which they say like with the naked eye. So this is the first thing.
Okay.
The other thing is about the Imam al-Asr, which is the special about Imam al-Asr. There is a hadith tradition in the Kitab al-Ghaybah of Sheikh Tusi.
Yes.
When the Prophet was at Mi'raj, when he was coming back, he saw 12 nur, 12 lights.
Yes.
And he asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about one of the lights which was so much lightning,
brighter
than the others.
Yes.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala replied to the Prophet there. He said, "Huwa al-Qa'im." This is Qa'im.
Yes.
Because we say Qa'im to Imam Mahdi. Imam Mahdi. Huwa al-Qa'im. Muhallilu halali wa muharrimu harami. When he will come, he will turn back my halal to halal and haram to haram. Today we can see in the banking system we have the interest, which is riba.
Yes.
You know, it's been mixed with the other concepts
yes.
that we have. There are many other things. You know, yes. in the Muslim countries, when you go, people, you know, unfortunately, the Muslims drink alcohol or, you know, they use the haram means
yes.
of
yes,
income
yes.
and all those
and
things.
Transactions, that's
so,
right.
So basically, Imam will come and he will firmly apply the rules, which a jurist cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because a jurist, obviously, he is bound because people does not obey him as an imam,
yes.
an infallible imam. These are the limitations that he has.
That's right.
why I said this is not a perfect model, but this is something which is closer to the to what Imam Mahdi will come and do.
Okay, that's all right.
Well,
but as you said, this is a close model, we can say, to that, and it needs perfection, isn't it?
Yes.
It is not that so. It is day by day, it has to progress up until that time. Inshallah, that these models will be successful in applying, as you said, those guidelines. Okay, but all in all, Imam asked Sheikh Rouhani, we can say this is the last question for you, is not only a hope for Shias or Muslims, but for all the people around the world to establish a just system, isn't it?
Yes, of course. One point I wanted to add to our guest that is this, that, you know, in the main principles of Islam, there's no disagreement.
Yes.
You know, the same will be the case with Imam Hassan Rahunafida.
Okay.
For example, Salat is wajib, is obligatory.
Yes.
We are 100% sure that the Imam will not tell us that, yeah, Namaz is not wajib. I mean, prayer is not wajib. Or same is the case, for example, with the main principles of Islam, there's no disagreement among fuqaha and among even among Sunni and Shia scholars.
Okay.
So that's why these main principles will be the same.
Yes.
But of course, there are some, we can say, kind of secondary kind of issues yes. sometimes that based on their different methods, different
mm-hmm.
kind of research they've done, of course, they might came to a kind of disagreement. Then
okay.
Imam will reform those kind of
yes.
Disagreements, of course. So yes, in many other religions, as you rightly mentioned, they believe in and the last savior.
Yes.
We see that even in Zoroastrianism, in Christianity, even in Judaism, in many other religions, even Buddhism, we have
Buddhism,
the,
Hinduism,
yeah,
all
Hinduism,
they believe
yeah.
in that.
In
that's
all
right.
these kind of religions, we have
okay.
a hope that the last savior will come and will
yes.
save the people.
Inshallah.
This is a kind of hope that everyone
okay.
has.
That's right.
Yes.
And we hope that, inshallah, we could witness. This is really the hope for all the truth seekers and justice seekers across the world to taste the reappearance of Imam As and to we can say live in a world full of justice, which is really difficult because the Jabhatul Batil is also active, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an easy task to be done. And inshallah, the reappearance of Imam As, we are an eyewitness to that in our lifetime and lifespan, inshallah. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The record-breaking inflation in the United Kingdom on the one hand and the multiple growth of interest rates and the increase in loan costs on the other hand are reducing the purchasing power of the British public day by day. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has covered this story and tells us more. Business owners have been warned that thousands of firms face collapse this year as the cost of living crisis continues. According to insolvency firm Begbie's Traynor, last year the number of companies on the brink jumped by more than a third. They expect this number to rise this year due to higher costs and consumers cutting back on spending. Julie Palmer, a partner at the firm, says they have been receiving an increasing number of calls from business owners who are left concerned over whether they should carry on. The firm says the number of companies in critical financial distress jumped by 36% in the last 3 months of 2022. This is defined by if a company has more than £5,000 in country court judgments or a winding up petition against it. The number of country court judgments served against companies in 2022 jumped by 52% compared with 2021. Julie Palmer says that up until now, low interest rates and loans had helped firms, while COVID loans and longer time to pay taxes during the pandemic also provided support. However, she says there is nothing on the horizon in terms of what might replace them. A backlog in the insolvency courts due to COVID has delayed some company collapses. Julie Palmer said the courts were closed for business, so nobody could take recovery action against non-payers, and we are beginning to see those cases push through now. These challenges have already proved lethal for some business owners who admit that the pressures of keeping their businesses running feel like a never-ending nightmare. Britain recently cemented a new downgraded spot in the world's economic rankings after being overtaken by India. According to the Centre for Economics and Business Research, the United Kingdom dropped from 5th to 6th biggest economy earlier than expected and now won't move for 15 years. The consultancy's World Economic League table said, but it happened in 2021 instead. The annual report now expects the United Kingdom's position to remain stable at sixth place over the next 15 years. The report warns UK growth will no longer exceed that in the rest of Europe in the coming years. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Business activity contracted at its fastest pace in 2 years in December as the high cost of living restricted household spending and companies cut investment, raising the prospect of a British recession. According to a closely watched survey, the services sector, which accounts for about three-quarters of private sector output, faced the biggest squeeze since the second COVID-19 lockdown. A slump in manufacturing output dating back to last August continued in January. Illustrating the effects of high energy prices, rising interest rates and falling consumer demand, business reported a sustained downturn in new orders that meant they were churning through backlogs of old orders to maintain staffing levels. The Standard & Poor's Global SIPS Flash Purchasing Managers Index, which includes 80% of the survey's responses from the services and manufacturing sectors, dropped below the level expected by city economies to 47.8 from 49 in December. A reading below 50 indicates activity has contracted. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at Standard & Poor's Global Market Intelligence, said, "Industrial disputes, staff shortages, export losses and the rising cost of living and higher interest rates all meant that the rate of economic decline gathered pace again at the start of the year." Chris Williamson added, "Weaker than expected PMI numbers in January underscored the risk of the United Kingdom slipping into recession. Britain is expected by many economists to suffer a recession in the first half of 2023 before a modest recovery later on in the year. Inflation, which has stayed above 9% since last April, is forecast to fall back before the end of the year, taking the pressure off the Bank of England to keep raising its base rate much above the current 3.5%. Headline, annual inflation in the United Kingdom is currently 10.5%, well above the Bank of England's 2% target. British firms reported hiking their prices to pass on more than 18 months of rising raw materials and energy costs, with the addition of recent increases in staff wages. Chris Williamson said the overall rate of decline indicated also remains only modest, but this is undeniably a disappointing start to the year for the United Kingdom, reflecting not just short-term hits to growth, to economic growth, such as strike action and the rise in energy costs due to the Ukraine war, but also highlighting the ongoing damage to the economy from longer-term structural issues such as labour shortages and trade woes linked to Brexit. Russia Today has also covered this story and tells us more. According to the latest figures released by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, Household Finances Survey on Wednesday, 25th of January, Britain's poorest households are among the worst hit by the cost of living crisis, as living standards are struggling to keep up with inflation. The median disposable income for the poorest fifth of the population dropped 3.8% in the financial year through to March of 2022, while wages and benefit payments also failed to keep up with skyrocketing inflation. The data exposes how the squeeze is increasing inequality in the United Kingdom as an unbridgeable gap opens up between the highest and the lowest income households. It also shows the struggle to raise living standards since the nation voted to quit the European Union back in 2016, as Britain's slowing economy weighs on wages. The median household disposable income declined by 0.6% from the 2021 financial year, with worse expected to come as inflation topped four-decade highs last November. By the end of the period covered by the Office for National Statistics data, inflation had surged to 7%. Meanwhile, the richest fifth of the country enjoyed 1.6% growth versus a 3.8% drop for the worse-off and a 2.4% slump for the second-poorest fifth of the households. Since the Brexit vote, living standards in Britain have barely increased. The poorest fifth of the population have seen their median disposable income plunge from just above $20,000 in 2016-2017 to $17,900 in 2021-2022. By contrast, the richest fifth of the population have gone from $78,000 to $81,500. During the latest year, the increasing divide was driven by wages and salaries, which dropped 7.5% for the poorest households and grew by 7.8% for the richest. Meanwhile, a former Bank of England bigwig warned of more pain to come for millions of British households from rising mortgage costs. Andy Haldane, who was the bank's chief economist until 2021, predicted real wages would fall again this year because of the impact of punishingly high inflation. The Bank of England is forecast to hike its main interest rate from 3.5% to 4% next week to try to cool inflation, which has begun to ease. That will hit millions of borrowers in Britain with variable rate mortgages and those looking for new home loans.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.